This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us as we discuss the important events of this week with our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hi.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has produced an important Key of David program. It's titled Germany and Russia's Secret War Against America. It's airing this weekend. Be sure to go to thetrumpet.com and watch that program. And he also expanded it into an article for the Trumpet print edition. Just yesterday, we sent our September edition off to the printer with this as the cover story. It's quite an electrifying article. It'll be available on the website next week. There's a lot in the news right now about collusion with Russia, and people focused especially on the supposed collusion between Donald Trump and Russia. But this is a much bigger story of actual collusion between German leaders and Russia. And this week, there were some interesting meetings taking place that underline this point. For this, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, so on July 24th, German Chancellor Angela Merkel met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, which is not too unusual. But then she also at that meeting was Russia's Chief of the General Staff, General Valery Gerasimov. And that is very unusual. Gerasimov, he is banned from visiting the European Union. He's on the list of people who are sanctioned. And so Germany had to give him a special waiver just for this trip to take place. A German government spokesman said that they talked about the Middle East, especially Syria, and that they talked about Ukraine. And that's about all they said. So you've got an unusual meeting, unusually low amounts of detail. The foreign policy spokesman for Germany's Free Democratic Party, he's Free Democrats, they're an opposition party. They're kind of a pro-free market party. But he said he called the meeting regrettable and odd, and he said that the silence about it was suspicious. So this is making a lot of people pay attention in Germany. And the chief of the general staff is kind of an unusual foreign official to meet with. Mm-hmm. I mean, the only times really, for example, that foreign leaders met regularly with the chiefs of the general staff was like in World War II, where chief of the Imperial General Staff Alan Brooke would go and meet Roosevelt with Churchill, and the American Chief of Staff Marshall would talk to Churchill. That when you're kind of coordinating,
yes,
practical on the grounds, fighting, our troops will be there, yous will be. That's when you start having politicians meet foreign chiefs of the General Staff. Something like this is very unusual.
The details that they did say that they spoke about the Middle East, especially Syria and Ukraine, that is interesting. I mean, you'd have to say those certainly are points of, high interest, I guess, for Russia, but also for Europe. How much can we take from that? Like you said, the details are extremely sketchy, but it does seem like they would have a whole lot to talk about there, and it does impact security issues.
That's right. And one more detail they did say is when it came to Syria, they were talking about, or one of the things they talked about, was the return of refugees. So
sending them back from Europe to Syria. Is that what you mean?
That's what I think they mean by that. I think all they said was the return of refugees. But I think that's probably the most likely. And you think about that and you start to see the possibility of some kind of grand bargain. There are plenty of possibilities for a grand bargain, but specifically in Syria there, where Miss Merkel's biggest headache is the refugee crisis. They had 1 million people come in a short amount of time. Well, what if they were able to do have some kind of agreement with Russia where they could send a whole load of those refugees back to Syria?
Mm-hmm.
That would be huge politically in Germany. So maybe that would save Angela Merkel's legacy. if she could have something like that. So,
that's
a very interesting prospect.
Well, you know, it is just having put this this trumpet issue together, this article by Gerald Fleury, he points back to the statements that he was making back when Russia was actually taking over portions of Ukraine, that he felt like the silence of Germany as that was happening indicated that they had made some kind of an agreement. And of course, this relationship and the agreement between Germany in particular and Russia, the history of that going back to the days of Molotov-Ribbentrop, show that whenever they're in this kind of deal-making mode, that's a sign that one or the other or both parties is preparing themselves for war. They're basically trying to shore up their security through some kind of an agreement in order to give them a freer hand to take firmer action. And Gerald Fleury has talked about the fact that they very well may be making these kinds of deals and seeing the way that they're so silent over some of these major issues, you know, these incursions that Russia has been making, underlines that.
Yeah, and Ukraine was really interesting because you had this situation where Germany, for just a few billion, they could have bought Ukraine. There was a chance there where if they had just stepped in and offered a few billion in aid, I can't remember how much it was, but I mean, in terms of grand strategy, it wasn't a huge amount, and they didn't do it.
Yep.
And that was, you know, it was a very interesting missed quote unquote opportunity if you were expecting them to take advantage of that. But it would make a lot more sense for them to have not stepped in then because they had been talking to Russia. But you do have to watch these kind of deals as they come up between them, because this is something that there's a long history of Germany and Russia getting together. I mean, you spoke about the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. You can go all the way back to like the late 19th century, where Prussia, the biggest German state at the time, got together with Austria and Germany, and Austria and Russia, and they just split Poland up between them until there was no Poland left. It was just kind of this deal where Prussia said, "Well, I'll take this bit, you take that bit," and they ended up just dividing it between the three of them. You had the Treaty of Rapallo first during the 1920s, where everyone kind of thought Germany and Russia's communist, they would be enemies. But they had this secret agreement, and it was years before anyone knew the full extent of it, where Germany was training their troops in Russia, where they were working together to develop tank warfare. Germany had secret weapons development facilities deep in Russia. So this was a secret agreement, and it took years before anyone knew about it. Then you had the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, where they basically just drew a line down Eastern Europe, said, you know, if you let us take this half, we'll take the other half. So, you know, a long history of working together. And like you say, when you do this, it's often because they're planning on going to war with third parties.
Yeah, so given that history, you would think that there would be much more international concern. You're hearing maybe some of these voices from some in Germany. You talked about the individual who expressed skepticism or said that this is suspicious. But really, considering all of the rhetoric that's being flung around about American-Russian collusion, it's remarkable to see this taking place. It's really not particularly secret. I mean, these meetings that you're talking about, this isn't secret. Mr. Fleury talks a lot in his article about the Nord Stream project. That's been going on for some years, and now that being expanded with the Nord Stream 2. The friendship between Gerhard Schroeder and Vladimir Putin. It's quite extraordinary how much evidence there is of it, and people are just looking the other way. But I would really encourage every listener to watch that Key of David program this weekend. Read that article. It'll be up on the website next week from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury, Germany and Russia's Secret War Against America.
And if I could add just one more thing on that, I'd say they're not ignoring this in Eastern Europe. And I think that's quite sobering. You know, politicians have taken to calling the Nord Stream 2 pipeline the Molotov-Ribbentrop 2 pipeline. Mm-hmm. You know, they know that history. They were immediately affected by it. They're worried about it. And, you know, as you say, this should be something that the West should be much more concerned about. So all the more reason to watch that Key of David and read that article.
Thank you for that, Richard. Well, one of the main points that Gerald Flurry makes in this article and in this Key of David program is about this planned gas pipeline project between Russia and Germany. And this will increase Russia's power and Germany's power and undermine NATO at the same time. To talk about this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this plan really does stand to undermine NATO, and one of the key pillars of what the Donald Trump administration is trying to accomplish. Actually, it was just this Wednesday, the European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker came to Washington, D.C., met with President Trump at the White House to discuss the escalating trade war between the United States and the European Union. If you'll remember, the Trump administration had put tariffs on European steel and European aluminum, and then the Europeans put retaliatory tariffs on a whole basket of U.S. goods. So at this meeting, the two leaders decided to take a step back, take a deep breath, don't declare any more tariffs for a while, and see if they can't come up with some ways to resolve this growing trade imbalance, with Germany exporting much more to the U.S. than the U.S. exports to Germany. And one of the things they talked about was trying to get Europeans to buy more U.S. soybeans and more U.S. natural gas. The Trump administration's made a really big deal about trying to sell U.S. natural gas to Europe. They're building new ports down in Corpus Christi, Texas. It takes a little bit to get the gas over there, is that you can't just send it in a pipeline like the Russians do. Mm-hmm. There's an ocean in the way. But so you need to liquefy it, load it on a ship, send it to Europe, unliquefy it, and then put it in a pipeline. Mm-hmm. And so you need we're actually already building liquefaction facilities in Corpus Christi and Houston and the Chesapeake Bay and other places. They're trying to get the Europeans to do more of that. And so that is something that President Trump and Juncker talked about. However, they do a lot of the analysts looking at this are making the point that Russia does stand as a significant obstacle to this, mm-hmm. just because they don't have to liquefy the gas, so it's 20% cheaper. The U.S. did export 3 billion metric tons of natural gas to Europe last year, which is a sixfold increase from the year before, so it's definitely going up. But still only about 1.5% of what Russia exports to Europe. We spent $3 billion, sounds like a lot. They sent 193 billion metric tons to Europe. So they definitely dominate that market. The Trump administration is trying to break in. Some countries, or at least some key figures in some countries, like Poland, may be willing to pay the extra 20% if it doesn't mean kowtowing to Vladimir Putin's dictatorship. Mm. But as we talked with Richard in the earlier segment, and as our editor-in-chief brought out in his Key of David program this week, it's not only Russia that's trying to stop the U.S. from becoming a huge gas exporter to Europe, but it's also Germany. I mean, there's many big and important business companies and figures in Germany who've put a lot of money into projects like the Nord Stream pipeline, who are pulling big salaries from projects like the Nord Stream pipeline, who have put a lot of stock in trying to keep these energy relationships with Russia strong, even to the point of, like I said, destroying and undermining the NATO alliance if need be. To be able to make sure that Germany and Russia together dominate Europe's energy market without American interference.
Yeah, it's quite an amazing story, and Donald Trump definitely has an uphill battle in trying to pitch American energy to Europe, not just because it's cheap, but because it doesn't align with their strategic interests. Mr. Flurry actually said in that program, he quoted Donald Trump saying Germany is totally controlled by Russia because they'll be getting 60 to 70% of their energy from Russia. and a new pipeline. So it is a really strong point that Donald Trump is making. It's hard to argue with.
Right. And you look at these networks of how this Nord Stream pipeline will change things. I mean, it does allow Russia to completely bypass Ukraine. I was doing some research for one of the maps that's going in this newest issue of the Philadelphia Trumpet, just looking at with this Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2. I mean, that just those two pipelines together stand to put 110 billion metric tons of natural gas into Germany, which is about two-thirds of not what Germany needs, but two-thirds of what all of Europe needs. And so that allows you to policely bypass Ukraine, send that gas to Germany, and then you'll have nations like Poland and Austria and the Czech Republic and France getting Russian gas that comes through Germany first. So they're reliant on Russia, but they're also reliant on Germany.
Right.
Well, something like Ukraine, I mean, you pretty much just have to assume that Ukraine's getting thrown under the bus. 5 years ago, you were thinking that maybe Ukraine might join European Union, or we'd even discussed before about the possibility of them being the European Union and Russia dividing that nation down the middle. But this Nord Stream changes the calculus enough that it looks like it's almost kind of like the Stalin Ribbentrop Pact from World War II,
right,
where Ukraine has been offered up as a peace offering to Vladimir Putin in return for the rest of Eastern Europe having to rely on Germany for their energy.
Yeah, definitely a major point that Gerald Fleury makes in that article and in that Key of David program, just how much of cause for concern it is when we see this kind of dealing going on between these two nations. Well, we appreciate that. I would definitely encourage you to watch that program and watch for that article, as we mentioned. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. The issue of Taiwan's independence from China took an interesting turn this week. For this story, we'll turn to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, on Wednesday, three of America's major airlines, American, Delta, and United, all caved into Chinese pressure to change the way they describe Taiwan on their websites. This was in response to a letter that China's Civil Aviation Administration had sent out back in April. They mailed this letter to more than 40 different international airlines who have destinations in China. And the letter basically said you need to change your websites to no longer imply that Taiwan is an independent country and instead call it Taiwan, China. And the letter said, you know, if the airlines fail to comply within 30 days, their operations in China could be severely disrupted. And China is now the world's second busiest aviation market, only behind the United States, and it's actually expected to surpass the United States in the next few years. So that was a threat that these carriers took very seriously. Several carriers, including British Airways, Air Canada, Lufthansa, and Philippine Airlines, really swiftly and completely obeyed China and made those changes. And then over the next couple of weeks, Japanese and South Korean carriers sort of begrudgingly followed suit. But in the United States, the White House denounced this demand. They called it Orwellian nonsense. And the authorities urged American carriers to just ignore it. So these American carriers ended up requesting an extension from China, and they were given until July 25th. And then for the next couple of months, they just kind of held out, hoping that the governments of the U.S. and China would come to a resolution before that deadline arrived. But there was no resolution, so on Wednesday, the day of the deadline, all three of them updated their websites. They ended up caving in to China's demands and just kind of playing along with this mind game, basically, that says no one is allowed to say that Taiwan is sovereign. You know, we have always been at war with East Asia. Taiwan is a part of communist China. So it is symbolic, but it's still quite a victory for China.
Yeah, it was just a couple of weeks ago that it seems maybe it was a week or two ago, you were talking about how Xi Jinping was likely to increase his pressure on Taiwan. This seems like a very, even though it is kind of a small, picky thing, just the way that foreign airports are listing their routes to Taiwan, it's still very practical, and it seems like it's very much in line with what you were saying.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Xi Jinping is in a position now to ramp up pressure on the Taiwan issue in a way that I don't think we've seen any Chinese leader since the two were split into two separate nations really, really apply pressure. And I think this is, you know, in a way it seems a little bit trivial and symbolic, but it does show the path that he is headed toward. And I think we can expect a lot more pressure.
Yeah,
in that direction.
The difference between the way that the White House responded and the way that these airline companies have responded is interesting. The fact that they essentially ignored the White House saying, no, we're not going to comply, and said, no, we're going to comply. This is going to be best for us from a business standpoint. It does make you wonder how much more capitulation you might see, even from a grassroots level or economic level versus diplomatic and government level.
Yes, well, China knows that it's an economic heavyweight, you know, and as I mentioned there, it is the world's second largest aviation market at this point. And these companies, they don't want to risk infuriating the White House. If President Trump were to tweet about their capitulation, that would be, you know, that would be something they would like to avoid. But also, they can't risk losing all that Chinese business. They do have to worry about their bottom line. So what they ended up doing is actually kind of meeting halfway in between. They did remove references to Taiwan as an independent country, which was the main part of China's demand. But all three of them stopped short of specifically saying that Taiwan is a part of China. Mm-hmm. They kind of just avoided saying what country it's in altogether. In the case of Delta, it's kind of strange that they have a grammatical anomaly on their website. Now it just says, let me see, they list it as TPE Taipei, which is the airport code, mm-hmm. and then the name of the capital city. And then there's a comma and nothing after the comma.
So. After that would normally come the country.
Exactly.
And they just left it blank.
Right. So it's just this awkwardly dangling comma there that says, okay, hopefully neither Trump nor Xi Jinping will be angry at us. Here's a dangling comma. I don't know what to do. So.
Right. Yeah. Well, very interesting to see that. So if somebody wanted more information on that, this Taiwan story is one that we've written quite a bit about over the years. Where would you send them?
Yes, we have an article. We'll post a link to it in the show notes. It's called Will the Two Chinas Become One? And that references a lot of what Trump Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has been saying about China and Taiwan as far back as 1998. He has been saying that because of America's weakness, China will end up swallowing Taiwan up. And that article just shows how steps over the years have really been leading to that happening and just how easily it could happen in the current framework.
Yeah. Thanks very much for that, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Oil tankers transiting through the Red Sea were attacked this week. They had an interesting target and even more interesting perpetrator. To learn about this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, there were two massive tankers that belonged to Aramco, the Saudi Arabian state-owned oil company, that were targeted by the Iranian-backed Houthis just north of the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. This is the 18-mile choke point of all sea transit coming from the Indian Ocean into the Red Sea that goes up into the Suez Canal and into the Mediterranean. And so the ships themselves only suffered minor damage. But the big story isn't the fact that they were targeted. The big story is the fact that Saudi Arabia has decided that it is no longer going to ship oil through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait at least they're putting a temporary hold on that, which is just stunning. The Kuwaiti government they haven't decided yet what they're going to do with their tankers, but they have released a statement saying that they are looking at the situation as well. So they might cancel their oil transit through the Red Sea as well. And so this is a very important development something that we've been watching for a long, long time, or at least a few years, just because we've talked about Iran and their support of the Houthis and how the reason that they were supporting the Houthis wasn't just to try and be the thorn in Saudi Arabia's side with somebody just south of the border of Saudi Arabia that could fire missiles into Saudi Arabia. The whole reason they're supporting them was so that Iran can govern this important sea choke point. And right now we've seen the first effects of that. Saudi Arabia is deciding no longer their super tank is going to come through here.
So really quite a feather in Iran's cap. In a way, it shows that energy strategy that we've been talking about really seems to be coming to fruition.
Yeah, it definitely does. We'll see how long it lasts. I do feel, though, that the rhetoric from the Iranians, this week as well, over the last couple of days, the Quds Force leader has come out directly attacking Donald Trump, saying it's not safe for U.S. ships in the Red Sea anymore. Don't threaten us. You start a war with us, we'll finish it. Mm-hmm. All in the context of the Red Sea. And so the oil price jumped because of this earlier this week, something that we're looking that we expect to Europe especially to take notice of. While Saudi Arabia is still able to send oil into the northern part of the Red Sea, just because they have a massive pipeline that they can ship from eastern Saudi Arabia, 5 million barrels per day across Saudi Arabia, and then it can be loaded on a tanker further north, they still will be able to get oil northward. However, now that Saudi Arabia has decided this is too dangerous for our ships, you're probably going to see other nations follow suit. And more importantly, you're going to see the massive insurance carriers around the world that have to insure the cargo on not just oil-faring ships, but also the other, I forget how many ships pass through here, but it's at a massive amount. I think it's, I'll just pull up the stat, what is it? It is 10% of global seaborne trade passes through here. And so you've got insurance companies that are going to say, if you want to go through there, we're going to have to jack up the prices because ships are getting attacked. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to have to make the decision whether it's a cheaper thing to go the 43% greater distance to get from Asia to Europe, going around the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa. And so there's a lot of flow-on effects here in world trade, not just about these couple of tankers. If other nations and insurance carriers decide it's too dangerous now and they start following Saudi Arabia's lead.
It seems like it would also be worth seeing how the United States responds to this. They've actually said that they would guarantee safe passage through Bab el-Mandeb.
Exactly. And what's yet to be seen. They said that for the Straits of Hormuz as well. I mean, the oil that goes through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, it's less than the Strait of Hormuz. You've got 18 million barrels per day coming out of the Straits of Hormuz on the other side of the Arabian Peninsula into the Bab el-Mandeb's about 5 million barrels per day. And so it is less. But I'm looking at this and just thinking that this has far more reaching implications than just oil. Just because of, as I said, 10% of global trade, $800 billion a year between Asia and Europe travels through here. That's a lot that could be jeopardized by the Iranians. Will the U.S. do something? And right now we do have the U.S. and Egypt in the Red Sea with some of their vessels. Maybe they'll head south to the Bab el-Mandeb and police it. But the Iranians aren't backing down from their rhetoric. They seem like they are ready, as they say, to use their asymmetrical warfare tactics in order to guarantee a hold on this choke point. Yeah, a lot of land-to-sea missiles they have, the Houthis have, and so they can target ships that way. And so they don't have to do too much to change the global calculus here. All they have to do is enough to make it too dangerous for ships to travel through here, and then economics will tell you that the ships are going to go the long way around Africa, and that will have really big implications in global trade. And maybe we'll finally see the Europeans, who are the main benefactors of this waterway being opened up, maybe we'll see the Europeans leap into action to try and ensure freedom of navigation through here.
Well, we do appreciate that. Brent has an article on thetrumpet.com called Citing Attacks on Tankers, Saudi Arabia Halts Oil Shipments into Red Sea. You can check that out at thetrumpet.com. It also links to an article that Gerald Fleury wrote some years ago, 2015, talking about just the strategy that Iran is implementing to control the whole sea lane from the Indian Ocean to the Mediterranean. The title of that article, Iran Gets a Stranglehold on the Middle East. You can find that at the end. It's linked to at the end of Brent's article, and we also will put a link to that in the show notes for the program today. We do appreciate that very much. Brent, you're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, Germany's novel solution to beefing up its military personnel, Russia shifting position regarding Iran, and China's secret weapon to destabilize America. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
In his recent visit to Europe to speak with other NATO leaders, U.S. President Donald Trump called on Germany to spend considerably more on its military. There are many in Germany who would like to do just that, but they have an interesting problem. And this week, the German Defense Ministry said they may have an interesting solution to this problem. To learn about this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
So Germany has a money shortage for its military. It wants to be able to spend more on it, but it's also got a manpower shortage. Even if they could find the money, they're short on people that want to serve in the army. Last year, the German military had 21,000 jobs that they weren't able to find personnel for. Now, it's been a very interesting shift in Germany, where there used to be this conscription force. When you have a conscription army, you don't generally have a problem filling the jobs. They ended that, and this has led to quite a lot of change in the role the German army has in society, because suddenly now your army has to advertise. It has to go around schools and promote serving in the army. It has to make catchy YouTube series about how great it is to serve in the German army. And all of this is very new and unusual for Germany, at least in terms of the last few decades, to have them kind of glorifying the armed forces like this. But now you've got this problem where even with that, they can't find enough jobs. And I think it means you're going to see them stepping forward more of their glorification of the armed forces and encouraging pride in that. But yes, on Saturday, the defense minister said that they're really seriously considering a different solution. And that would be to allow people from across the EU to serve in the German army.
So, yeah, that's extraordinary.
Yeah, it's a very interesting development, especially as you've got youth unemployment in some parts of regions of Italy and Spain as being at 50%. And you would imagine that the pay in the German army for some of those poorer parts of Europe, like Greece, like maybe some of the Eastern European countries, when you look at how much they would get for their money back home, the German army is probably a pretty attractive career choice. Mm-hmm. So you could open up the German army to people from all across Europe. Now, in terms of letting other people serve in your army, it's not necessarily hugely unusual. Other Commonwealth members, for example, can serve in the British army. I was sitting on a plane next to an American recruiter once flying in the US. He was trying to convince me to sign up for the US army. So other countries do this to a certain extent. But when you put this alongside other moves Germany's made over the last few years, I think that's when it becomes really interesting, because 2/3 of the Dutch army are now part of the German army. Mm-hmm. They've joined German forces. They're under German command. They're still based in the Netherlands, but they're under the German command structure. You've got very significant chunks, kind of very roughly like 1/3 to 1/2 of the Czech army and the Romanian army in the German army, under the German command structure, serving under German commanders. You've had German Defense Minister Ursula von der Leyen talking about this just being a path to creating a multinational panzer division that could be the nucleus of a European army. Mm-hmm. So Germany, if you're looking for an example of a European army, Germany's the best example right now. They don't necessarily get talked about so much, but you've got this army that is this umbrella force now for the best part of the militaries from four different nations.
Mm-hmm.
Poland's looking at doing a similar thing with their navy. So already it's really expanded beyond the borders of Germany. You take that next step and you open it up for anybody in the EU to come serve in the German army. And you're really seeing the German army become this EU army.
Yeah. Well, it is interesting. Every time we have a conversation about one of these developments, it's Germany at the center of it. They really seem to be pushing all of the frontiers that they can to move in the direction of a European army. This is a proposal. What's your sense of how likely it is to happen?
I think it is pretty likely. Just about everybody in the German coalition government is on board with it. The only possible wrinkle is that the SDP, the Social Democrats, the more left-wing part of the government, they've said that they'll only support it as long as EU nations that serve in the army are on the path to German citizenship.
Hmm.
So serve in the army for, I guess, probably something like 5 years, you get a German passport at the end. I don't think that would be a deal breaker for the other parties, especially as these days there's not really much difference between an EU citizenship and a German. You know, if you're an EU citizen from Greece, you can move to Germany, you can work wherever you want in Germany.
Yep.
You don't really get a huge number. I mean, I guess it's just about the right to vote, and that's about it. So I don't think that would be a huge concession. At the same time, I don't think it would be a big deal for the SDP to give it up. So with that being the only sticking point, it seems like it would be plain sailing from here on out for that idea.
Yeah. Well, if you could put it in prophetic context for our listeners, Richard, that'd be great.
So, well, 1953, for example, Herbert W. Armstrong warned about 10 powerful European nations will combine their forces. And he wrote that because Revelation 17 talks about 10 kings combining their strength and power. And you read the rest of that chapter, it's talking about an empire that's resurrected several times. It's talking about an empire that's led by a church. The only place that matches that description is Europe. So then you're looking at 10 European countries combining their strength and their power. So 10 European nations in this really close military alliance, mm-hmm. if not going all the way towards having just this combined army. It's something that you've seen this power when you've seen other European empires, you've seen this do this. You know, Napoleon, you know, he brought Poles and he tried to bring in as many people in from different countries into his army. Even during World War II, you had various different branches of the SS recruited from other countries. So we've seen it throughout history. It's specifically prophesied in the Bible. And so that's why we're watching for it. The Bible tells us it's going to happen. And we have more about this. We have a trends article, Why the Trumpet Watches Europe's Push Towards a Unified Military, that just really takes you step by step through those prophecies and shows you, why we're watching for this military power to rise in Europe.
Thanks for that, Richard. We turn now to Syria, this complex puzzle with several different competing interests at play. One that we're watching is what will happen with Iran. Bible prophecy says the alliance between Syria and Iran will fracture. Recent developments show how we might be seeing this happen. For this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, we've talked about this a lot on the program, and we're going to talk about it again this week, just because there was a development with the relationship between Israel and Russia, which does affect a lot of what's happening in Syria of late, at least. We had a high-level delegation from Russia come and visit Israel, basically out of the blue. It included the one of the defense ministers, as well as Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, one of the basically the right-hand man of Putin himself, in as far as it goes for foreign policy. And he came to Israel to discuss Syria and whether they could work out a deal with the Israelis. They offered and put on the table to Israel and said, Russia thinks that we can push back Iran 100 kilometers from the border, your border on Syria. Right now, Iranian troops are running around mad in Syria. And Israel has said we want them all the way out of Syria by the end of the war. That's our red line. Russia comes and actually gives up some territory, because before they said, well, we can push them out, I don't know, 20 or 30 miles. Now they said, is 100 kilometers enough? And Israel said, no, no, it's not enough. We want them gone. And what's interesting is all the reports that came out of this meeting is that the Russians didn't leave in a fit of anger. They understand the Israeli position. They see that Israel is a powerful player that needs to be compromised with in Syria if the Syrian civil war is going to die down. We have this situation where Israel has said, we don't want Iran here. We don't want them transiting weapons to Hezbollah and other proxies inside Syria. And so we're going to attack Iran from now until whenever. We're not going to stop if they keep this up. And Russia, of course, wants an end to the Syrian civil war. They don't want to keep on spending all their money down there. They're happy. They want to be the one in charge in Syria. And so if Israel's still jeopardizing the peace inside Syria because of Iran's actions, that's going to be bad for Putin. And so because of Israel's willingness to stand up for themselves, Russia is, it seems, acquiescing to Israel's demands, or at least taking them very much into consideration.
How much would the loss of Russian support rock Iran's world?
I don't think at this point I feel like the Assad regime, if it was just the Iranians that were going to stay there, that would be preserved. But you would have to worry about, if you're Assad, well, that means Israel's going to keep on attacking me and keep on attacking the Iranians. The Iranians always knew that this was a possibility going in. When they invited Russia down to help in 2015, there was a desperate need that they had for air power over Syria. And Russia said, we'll supply that to ensure that Assad stays in power and their own interests are preserved. And so there was always a time coming when Russia and Iran were going to fight over the spoils. And not one of them wants to play second fiddle to the other. Mm. I think the Russians would accept an Iranian influence in Syria as long as the Israelis stopped bombing Syria because of that. But the Israelis aren't going to stop. And so Russia has to work out some type of compromise. And that said, I think the Iranians, even we've seen rhetoric, there's articles coming out this week about a lot of even Rouhani talking about how, you know, they're worried about the Russian reaction, worried about what Russia's doing with Israel inside Syria, trying to pull Assad away from the Iranians. So I think they are concerned about it. The big question is, how much can Russia do? Can Russia fully oust Iran from Syria? Now, a lot of people are saying they can't. But as we're informed by Bible prophecy, which indicates that Iran is going to be pushed out of Syria somehow, we're looking at this and say, well, maybe the commentators are wrong on this. Maybe Russia does have enough power, at least with Assad, to say, oh, I'm with Russia, not with you, Iran. Mm-hmm. That if Assad wants to preserve his rule at this point, Iran is the pariah on the world stage. Russia is, but not as much as Iran. I think if Assad wants to stay in power, I think he might be willing to accept Russia's patronage rather than Iran's.
Yeah, to think that Syria would come to a point, Assad would come to a point where it would actually be in its interests to distance itself from Iran. That's really what we're seeing unfold here.
For sure. And that's, we had the, I think it was Assad, or was one, at least one of his yeah, it was Assad. He said just yesterday that the Russian forces are going to be needed for a long time to balance out the region inside Syria. So he's basically endorsing Russia there for the next 40 years, as he said. And so why come out and release a statement like that? You know is going to upset the Iranians. And so maybe we are seeing a turn from Assad towards the Russians.
So if people wanted more information, that our article, I'm just thinking of that article that Gerald Flory wrote some years back, How the Syria Crisis Will End, I believe was the title of it. That analysis still holds up remarkably well, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think that is what people should read. We say that often to go back to this article, but it is what we base our understanding on. That article, of course, is talking about the prophecy in Psalm 83, which shows that Syria isn't going to belong to the Iranian alliance. And so, yes, go and read that article, How the Syrian Crisis Will End.
Thank you for that, Brent. We'll go back to Asia now, and a quick story showing more military cooperation between China and Russia. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, China's People's Liberation Army has now officially taken ownership of its first batch of the Russian-made S-400 Triumph missile system. So this is it's the culmination of a deal that's been in the works for several years now. The contract was actually first signed back in late 2014, and it was worth about $3 billion. And this week, officials announced that the first delivery has now been made. It was actually made in April, but no one outside of the Russian and Chinese militaries knew about it until it was just announced this week. So China is the first country to buy this very advanced system from Russia, and they have another batch of them on the way that will be delivered sometime in the next few months. So this deal just shows that the Russia-China military cooperation is deepening and accelerating, and it shows that China's military power is growing. But this is a part of a really central trend that the Trumpet has been watching for quite a long time, and our predecessor magazine, The Plain Truth, has actually been expecting Russo-Chinese military cooperation for, over half a century now. And we have a detailed article that we'll be sure to link to in the show notes, but it's called Why the Trumpet Watches Russia Allying with China. And I'll just read a quick quote from that article. It says, "For over half a century, the Trumpet and our predecessor magazine, The Plain Truth, have been expecting Russia and China to partner up. We've expected it because Bible prophecy says that in the end time, the Russia-China axis will lead an Asian military bloc that will play a central role in World War III." And then it goes on to say, "The fact that this Russia-China axis has now suddenly arrived means the fulfillment of these Bible prophecies is astonishingly clear." So this article, it goes into numerous scriptural passages, such as Revelation 9:16 and Ezekiel 38. And it just shows that when we see these two nations increasing their military cooperation, then we should really see that as setting the stage for the next and final world war. So that article is Why the Trumpet Watches Russia Allying with China.
All right. Well, we'll put a link to that in the show notes for the program today. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. And while we're on the subject of China, we'll finish the program with an intriguing story about a secret weapon China is using to destabilize America. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
One of the most powerful ways America is being undermined today is drug addiction. Drug overdoses have killed over 700,000 Americans since the year 2000, just short of 750,000. And depending on the study estimates you use, they may be responsible for up to 50% of homicides or like drug-related violence, may be responsible for 50% of homicides, which would add another 150,000 to the total figure, actually bringing up pretty close to a million of just deaths due to drug addiction. Currently, drug addiction is the leading cause of death for those under 50, and the deadliest drug in America today is fentanyl. This is it's a synthetic opioid. Supposed to be similar to heroin, but 50 times more potent. And instead of being grown in naturally and then distilled in Latin America, fentanyl, or most the illicit fentanyl in the United States, is being manufactured in Chinese chemical labs. And then these chemical labs either just simply mail it to the U.S. through the postal system. It's small enough that it can usually pass customs. Or send it directly to Mexico for cartels to smuggle across the southern border. So there's over 20,000 people died in 2016 from a fentanyl overdose, making it a bigger cause of death than homicide, and something serious enough that President Trump personally brought it up to Chinese President Xi Jinping earlier this year. And the Chinese government has paid some lip service to being helped cracking down on this. They've blamed it on the mafia. They've blamed it on Chinese chemical companies doing illegal activities. Some are pretty skeptical of how much the Chinese government wants to crack down on these illegal activities by Chinese chemical companies, considering you are running a nation that's perfected the art of internet censorship unlike any other nation. It seems like it would be fairly easy for them. They can crack down on calling Taiwan the wrong name on the internet easily enough, but they can't seem to stop these publicly traded chemical companies from selling directly to Mexican cartels or to U.S. Private U.S. individuals through the Postal Service. And I've got an article that's going to be posted online within the next couple days that really does make the point that the Chinese government may well be doing this, turning a blind eye, that is, on purpose as a means to destabilize America. That's not unprecedented in recent Chinese history. I mean, during the Chinese Civil War, Mao Zedong quite famously instructed his some of his subordinates to grow poppies to make opium, and then he'd traffic opium into non-communist parts of China to destabilize the region, send in his guerrilla forces to conquer the region, and then outlaw all drugs after he'd conquered it. Once he consolidated his rule over all of China in 1949, they then nationalized the opium production and started using it as a foreign policy weapon against Japan and the United States of America. Back during the 50s and 60s, Chinese Premier Zhao Enlai was actually caught pretty actively managing that narcotics trade. Since China's kind of opened up to the world more in the 1980s, it's not quite as politically expedient to be seen actively managing the narcotics trade. But the U.S. military has done reports that China has done quite a bit of research into drug warfare as a possible asymmetrical warfare technique. And so by doing things under the table or just simply turning a blind eye to criminal activities in China, they're Chinese economy is actually making quite a bit of money on chemical manufacturing activities that are killing 750,000 Americans over a 2-decade period.
That's amazing.
Just looking at just kind of like past Chinese and even Soviet strategy to destabilize a rival by pushing drugs on them.
Right.
Those activities may very well be continuing to this day.
Yeah, and the point that we make so often with respect to the drug war and Mexican drug cartels, the problem is only there because of Americans' susceptibility to get involved with these drugs and to become addicted to these kinds of drugs. If we stayed away from them, then we wouldn't have a problem at all. But We're sort of creating our own problem, aren't we? That is quite an extraordinary story. Watch for that. That article is going to be going up on thetrumpet.com from Andrew Miller. The title, Fentanyl, China's Secret Weapon to Destabilize America. Quite a fascinating subject there. I was unaware of any of that that you were just describing there, including some of those just jaw-dropping statistics about the severity of the drug addiction and overdose problem within the United States. Quite extraordinary. We appreciate that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to the articles and literature that we discussed on the program today. You can email us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters at thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Nachtigall.
Great to be here.
It's been a pleasure.
Grazie.
Thank you.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of William E. McLaren. It is possible to live very near to God under every conceivable environment. And what is possible is our highest duty. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, Keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.